Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The 2010 New START nuclear weapons agreement between the U.S. and Russia has expired, although Putin offered to extend it for a year. An interview with Susie Snyder from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. How limited are the nuclear arsenals? How do hypersonic missiles change the situation? The U.S. and Russia have both increased spending in the past few years. And how does China's arsenal change the balance? Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The New START nuclear arms treaty between Russia and the U.S. has expired, technically leaving both countries free to develop nuclear weapons without limits. The United States has refused an offer by Russia's Vladimir Putin to extend warhead limits and says that any new deal would have to include China. Beijing has rejected calls to enter the talks at this stage. Experts warn China's nuclear arsenal has been growing faster than any other country's. New START was signed in 2010 by then U.S. President Barack Obama and then Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Russia and the U.S. control more than 80% of the world's nuclear warheads, but the absence of any treaty is prompting fears of a new arms race.
And Susie Snyder is joining us now from the Netherlands. She is the program coordinator at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us. Could the U.S. and Russia still reach an agreement at the last minute at such a crucial moment for nuclear proliferation?
It would be absolutely fantastic if they would reach such an agreement. But unfortunately, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed that Donald Trump will not seek to maintain this bilateral limit with Russia and is not looking to do something right now, but instead wants to involve China. So while there could be a last-minute reprieve or a last-minute agreement to Russia's offer to extend the existing plan for a while, it's not looking very likely. And that is extremely concerning to everyone in the world.
Did the U.S. and Russia still respect the limits set by New START even after cooperation was suspended?
Well, we did miss the bilateral consultation committee. It's really important to have technical experts talking to one another about the arsenals. And that was a gap. But according to our open source estimates, we've seen that the limit of numbers of nuclear weapons, the numbers of delivery systems have been maintained in the requirements under the New START Treaty. But I do want to note those requirements were higher than what's existing even in the rapidly growing Chinese arsenal. So it's not like the numbers were coming down to the level of the UK or France. They still have nearly 6,000 warheads each, which are ready and can be used at any moment.
We have seen that Russia is also developing hypersonic missiles, which it's already being used in the war in Ukraine. How significant has this shifted the strategic balance?
Now, the introduction of hypersonic missiles, which is not solely a Russian issue, the U.S. is also developing hypersonic missiles, as are France and other nuclear-armed countries. But what this does is it confuses the battlefield. It makes what is easily identifiable, the parabolic arc from an intercontinental ballistic missile, it's no longer makes it less predictable, which means that ideas of missile defense are also less likely to work in these situations. So it decreases stability, it decreases transparency, and unless we have some new efforts to negotiate limits and open access to information, we're going to see some real problems, and it confuses the battlefield. And one of my big concerns here is that those who are watching and ready to respond, should they detect an incoming missile, will not know if that missile is conventionally or nuclear armed, and they may indeed fire a nuclear weapon in response, leading to the worst conflagration the world has ever seen.
Okay, so the threat of miscalculation has gone up then significantly, I'm hearing from you. There are many fears that we are in a new nuclear arms race, and I'm wondering where that ranges on your spectrum of fears right now. Do you share those fears? And if so, how could this differ or compare to the Cold War era?
So what we saw in the Cold War was a rampant and quick buildup of technology and capabilities on both sides. But it was primarily a bilateral race. And now that has changed. Now there are more actors involved and there are more hotspots involved. Nevertheless, the U.S. and Russia still remain the biggest actors on the nuclear playing field, and they are increasing the spending on their nuclear arsenal significantly. In 2024, Russia spent $8.1 billion, and the U.S. spent $56.8 billion just on their nuclear arsenals. And those numbers have been consistently going up. But what we're seeing, China's numbers are going up. France, UK, India, Pakistan, Israel, all of them are increasing their spending. And what worries me the most is that they're making it seem as if the use of nuclear weapons would somehow not be as bad as we all know it would be.
Susie Snyder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Thank you so much for joining us to share those views.
That interview is from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. We start with three press reviews. First, covering the backlash in Europe from the Epstein files. Then Spain and many other European nations are preparing social media bans for children. Finally, criticism of the Washington Post laying off a third of its staff. Right-wing populist Laura Fernandez won the presidential race in Costa Rica, promising economic growth, a crackdown on drugs, and complete construction of a prison modeled on El Salvador's notorious CICOT megaprison. Human Rights Watch has reported that Trump has intensified the downward spiral on human rights and American democracy. France 24.
You're starting with the backlash to the Epstein files that continues to engulf European nations from palace to parliament.
That's right, Charles. Let's start with parliament, actually. Let's look at the front pages of the British papers today. All of them, most of them at least, all talking about Lord Peter Mandelson, the high-ranking Labour Party member who is splashed across the front pages today, comes after he was revealed to have passed on confidential information pertaining to a 500 billion euro bailout of the euro. He had passed this information on to Jeffrey Epstein while as a cabinet minister in the years 2009 to 2010. MPs are seeking a police probe against him in the wake of those revelations. You see here the Daily Mail calling him Labour's dark lord. Not surprisingly, Daily Mail being quite conservative. But The Guardian also talking about that police inquiry. And in its editorial today, they say that he should leave the House of Lords too, while also noting that this is a test for Labour's pro-business factions, which, quote, valorize proximity to wealth as having political maturity.
Starting us off with coverage of Spain's plan for a social media ban, what do the Spanish front pages look like?
Well, they're all talking about this plan for the social media ban. So let's start with La Vanguardia here. This is their front page this morning here. Their headline says Spain plans to ban social media for kids under the age of 16. The paper also goes on to quote Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, who says that he wants to protect minors from, quotes, a space of addiction, abuse, pornography, manipulation and violence. Now, Spanish daily El País has this opinion piece here today, which celebrates the policy and says that, quotes, it's good to see the global debate on teenagers and social media finally moving towards holding companies accountable for their harmful practices. There's another opinion piece in El Mundo here, slightly more sceptical than El País, in particular when it comes to implementing the ban. It asks how the government plans to block teenagers from using platforms they have been on since childhood. The paper also criticises what it calls Save the Planet rhetoric. Now, despite some reticence, this idea of a social media ban is spreading. This is a Diário de Noticias in Portugal after France, Denmark, Austria, Spain. Portugal is also considering the idea of a social media ban. The paper says that a bill suggesting a plan for future socials ban was presented to Parliament on Monday. Now, this topic has also spread to Greece. We can have a look here at Kati Marini here. This is a Greek daily. It reports that the government is about to announce a Greek version of the ban, this time banning social media for children under the age of 15.
Now to more on the Washington Post, laying off a third of its staff, a decision long time in the coming, but nevertheless sending shockwaves through the newsroom.
Yeah, that's right. In the press, outside of the Washington Post, because this is all I could find this early Thursday morning in the Washington Press, an article written by the Associated Press agency mentioning the staffing cull at the Washington Post, a storied U.S. paper owned now by Amazon's Jeff Bezos. More than 300 people have been laid off. That's about a third of the staff at the Washington Post, including the whole Middle East correspondence and editors department, the sports department, and the literary reviews department. It's a sad ending, Stuart, for a paper who, remember, whose reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein's, they made history 50 years ago for the Watergate scandal. The reactions in the press, very, very strong. This is from The Atlantic, which calls it the murder of the Washington Post. In The New Yorker today, they talk about how Jeff Bezos was brought in to save the paper and he contributed to its decline. And indeed, there's a lot of anger towards Jeff Bezos from within the Washington Post. As this article from the International Business Times notes, some staffers are crying betrayal. They see that Jeff Bezos didn't make any comments. He's really maintained a radio silence around these layoffs, which many see as him trying to, quote, survive Trump rather than protect the paper's independence. In other words, many see him as having ingratiated himself to Trump by culling a paper seen as Trump skeptic.
A decisive victory in the first round of Costa Rica's presidential election. Laura Fernandez, the Conservative Party's candidate, has won nearly half the votes to become the second woman to lead the country. She celebrated with her supporters and also with her mentor, the popular outgoing president, Rodrigo Chavez.
Believe me, your work, your legacy for the benefit of this blessed people is in good hands. And Mr. President, I will go even further. What you have built with so much effort and courage for this blessed homeland, I take as a treasure that I will multiply for the greater good of our country.
39-year-old Fernandez is a career civil servant and political advisor. She promised to make fighting crime her priority, and her plan is uncompromising. Complete construction of a high-security prison modeled after El Salvador's CICOT megaprison, increase drug crime sentences, and declare a state of emergency in areas plagued by crime. It's a program similar to that of El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, a man Fernandez openly admires.
I am a server and defender of freedom, life, and family. My future government will have only one purpose: to strengthen the rule of law in service to Costa Rican families.
Long considered one of the safest countries in Central America, Costa Rica has seen a spike in drug-related homicides under President Chavez. Because Fernandez was hand-picked by Chavez, the opposition fears the outgoing president will continue to govern behind the scenes. And indeed, Fernandez has vowed to include Chavez in her own government.
Donald Trump's return to the White House has intensified a downward spiral on human rights. That's the conclusion of Human Rights Watch's annual report. In just 12 months, the Trump administration has carried out a broad assault on key pillars of American democracy, the report says.
The human rights movement is in trouble. It's a dangerous time for human rights. The Trump administration is attacking the multilateral rules-based world order in a way that could really undermine the human rights movement.
Human Rights Watch points, among other things, to immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, and the deployment of armed agents involved in abusive raids. Human Rights Watch also repeats its finding that the U.S. engaged in enforced disappearances, a crime under international law, by transferring Venezuelan migrants to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. In a 2025 report, the HRW documented allegations from the men that they had been tortured. The report warns actions like these, combined with long-standing efforts by Russia and China to weaken the global rules-based order, have left the international human rights system in peril.
The human rights movement is facing a triple threat: the Trump administration, the Russian government, the Chinese government, which may be adversaries from a strategic standpoint, but they have one thing in common, is that they don't want the UN, they don't want the human rights system.
The findings stand in contrast to the U.S. government's latest report on global human rights abuses, a report that toned down sections on countries seen as allies to Trump. It claimed, among other things, that El Salvador had seen no credible reports of significant human rights abuses.
Those press reviews and reports were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites. On to NHK World Radio Japan. Record-breaking snowfall is continuing in much of Japan. Trump has been stepping up pressure on Cuba, saying he is negotiating with their leaders, and the Wall Street Journal reports that regime change is planned by the end of the year. NHK Japan.
Weather officials here in Japan are urging people to brace for more heavy snowfall from Friday through Sunday. They're calling for caution over possible traffic disruptions. The Japan Meteorological Agency said on Thursday, heavy snow is expected to peak along the Sea of Japan coast on Sunday from northern to western parts of the country.
Parts of northern to western Japan have already seen record snow accumulation, and there's a possibility that more snow could pile up.
Blizzards are forecast for northern parts of the nation mainly on Friday. The agency says the snowfall could be of warning-level intensity, especially on the Sea of Japan side. It also says accumulation may take place even in the Kyushu region and along the Pacific coast from western to eastern Japan. The areas rarely get much snow.
U.S. President Donald Trump has been stepping up pressure on Cuba. He says Washington is in talks with senior Cuban officials, and he believes the two sides are going to make a deal.
Well, Cuba's a failing nation. It has been for a long time, but now it doesn't have Venezuela to prop it up. So we're talking to the people from Cuba, the highest people in Cuba, to see what happens.
He has not said what kind of deal he's pursuing. But the Wall Street Journal reports the U.S. president is seeking regime change by the end of the year. Trump added that he also wants people who have fled to the U.S. to be able to return to Cuba. On Thursday, Trump said that Havana constitutes an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. security. And he signed an executive order to impose tariffs on countries that supply oil to the Caribbean nation. Concerns are growing from a humanitarian perspective that Cuba's living conditions could deteriorate due to energy shortages.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. NHK may be easily found at most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I am truly grateful for donations. They are essential for the weekly production and website fees for this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations around the world. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum announced that they will be sending humanitarian aid, including fuel, to Cuba. On Tuesday, thousands of people marched through the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, demanding the release of President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, exactly 1 month after the U.S. military kidnapped the couple in a deadly nighttime raid. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has announced that humanitarian aid will be sent to Cuba this week, including food and other supplies, and she reaffirmed that her nation is working through diplomatic channels to supply fuel to the island. She said, "We are exploring all diplomatic avenues to send fuel to Cuba, because this is not a matter of governments, but rather a matter of support to prevent a humanitarian crisis in Cuba. In the meantime, we will send food and other aid." The Mexican president explained that the shipment will be prepared by the Mexican Navy. In the context marked by Washington's threat to impose tariffs on any country that sends crude oil to Cuba, the Mexican president also contradicted her U.S. counterpart, Donald Trump, who claimed that he had asked Mexico to stop sending oil to the island and that she had complied. She said, "The issue of sending oil to Cuba has not been discussed in any of the conversations. The only time the topic was addressed was in a conversation that the Secretary of Foreign Affairs, Juan Ramón de la Fuente, had with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Last Thursday, Trump signed an executive order declaring a supposed national emergency in the United States and establishing a process to apply tariffs to the assets of nations that send crude oil to Cuba. This decree, another tightening of the blockade imposed on Cuba for more than 60 years, is part of Washington's current policy of maximum pressure against the island, and attempts to justify it in the interest of U.S. national security and foreign policy." During a plenary session of the ruling Morena's party's deputies, Foreign Minister de la Fuente deemed the lack of humanitarian aid unacceptable when it is needed and reaffirmed his country's commitment to providing it to any nation in need. The Mexican president had said that her country will seek ways to support Cuba, and emphasize the importance of preventing a humanitarian crisis in Cuba with the controversial measures that have been announced now by the United States. Activists, members of parliament, and representatives of political parties in Mexico have all spoken out in recent days in support of Cuba in the face of the new U.S. measure, which many have described as unjust, cruel, and anachronistic. Yesterday, Tuesday, February the 3rd, the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, was the scene of a massive popular mobilization demanding the return of the constitutional president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and the first lady, Celia Flores, abducted by the United States exactly 1 month ago on January the 3rd. The protest brought together workers, students, and social movements near the Provincia building in the Plaza Venezuela. From there, the march proceeded along Liberador and Urbaneta avenues, ending at the corner of Santa Catalina in the city center, where the demonstrators reaffirmed their commitment to fighting against foreign pressures. Through digital platforms, the vice president of the Mobilization and Events for the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, emphasized that this mobilization is a demonstration of the unwavering loyalty of Venezuelans to their president and the First Lady. Fernandez stressed that after 30 days, the president and his wife have been absent, the popular outcry has not diminished, emphasizing that national unity is the primary tool to confront the foreign siege and defend the country's sovereignty. The Venezuelan people, under the premise that no power can subdue an organized nation, have reiterated that the goal of the street protests is clear, the return of the Bolivarian leaders, while reaffirming their historical commitment to maintaining Venezuela as a free, independent, and sovereign territory. In the early morning hours of January the 3rd, 1 month ago, U.S. military forces bombed Caracas and several areas of three states, Aragua, Miranda, and La Guaira, an illegal incursion that left more than 100 people dead, including civilians and military personnel, among them 32 heroic Cuban combatants. During the attack, the presidential couple was kidnapped, illegally taken to the United States, where they remain imprisoned in a maximum security prison in New York City. In his first comments, his first declarations before a New York court, Maduro declared, "I am the president of Venezuela, and I am a prisoner of war. I was captured in my home in Caracas." The president's courage, as described by the Venezuelan people, has become a source of strength and resilience in every corner of the country. These are not just political mobilizations. They are acts of love that transform indignation into collective strength, as the protesters have emphasized. Every slogan heard this Tuesday on the first anniversary, the 1 month since the kidnapping of Maduro, the pledge of loyalty to peace and freedom, reminding the world that the identity of a foreign nation cannot be imprisoned. The sense of justice has transformed Venezuelan borders from the moment of the incursion and the kidnapping of the presidential couple. Not only have the Venezuelan people taken to the streets, but globally, protesters in a number of countries, including the United States, have demanded the return of Maduro and Celia to their nation. The rejection of the illegal military attack perpetrated by the Donald Trump administration has engendered an unprecedented wave of international solidarity. Under slogans such as "Hands off Venezuela" and "No to colonialism and fascism," they denounce the flagrant violation of sovereignty and human rights. These voices are not only demanding justice, but also rise up in defense of the right of peoples to self-determination, rejecting the use of war as a mechanism of subjugation.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Standard Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report up at the website for this show, which is outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. In April, the Shortwave Report will be celebrating having been on the air for 30 years without a break. For 27 years, the show is produced and distributed off the electrical grid using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.